That's okay. He's here tonight, and that's what it was all about. I would like for everyone to help me please welcome Burns.
Yeah, what he always says is, I hate his children, too, you know, I mean, when he starts off the line like that. I didn't say that he was on the phone too much to me. I said that my wife said when I came in one night, she said, Dave called tonight, and I think he ought to just join us for supper. He's with us every night when we get home. Which I didn't see anything wrong with that statement. We happened to enjoy him very much. I mean, even when I didn't get, when I wasn't there to get his messages, I thought they had a real spiritual ring to them on the phone when I got him on answering. And we said that, I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to have to get past that some way, like, you call me too much, you slob, you know. to his friends, right? I'm the heretic from Kentucky anyway, and I got to start behind that. My name's Burns Brady, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I'm really grateful to be here. I'm really happy to be here. I spoke in New Brunswick, I guess it was, in 1992, and I got a letter from there after it was over saying it was a wonderful talk, but if I ever came back into this part of the country, bring an interpreter. So, when I got here, this sweet young lady over here said, I just love your accent, you know, and so I went down and called my wife on the phone, and she's not there. She's at a retreat up in Notre Dame this weekend. I listened to the answering machine, and she does have a crazy accent. I didn't realize that. But, you know, I'm kind of reminded of when I was in medical school, and I was a medical student, we were making rounds one day on the psychiatry ward, and Dr. Billy Keller was the head of the chief of psychiatry. And as we were walking down the thing, he had his entourage. He's a typical psychiatrist, you know, he egomaniac. He was sitting up here and right down. Well, we all are, but I mean, most of them are worse than anybody else. And he was in the front, and there was the chief resident, and here was the second resident, and here was the third, all the way down to the little medical students that's down here, and a bunch of us like little fledgling ducklings walking along. Okay. So we go past this one cell, actually. It was behind bars, and there's a guy there, and everybody called Dr. Keller. You know, he is either Dr. Keller or God. You know, that's what we called him. He preferred God, but he would accept Dr. Keller. I hadn't thought of this story in ages, but when talk about the accent, it reminded me of it. When we walked by this particular thing, this guy in the cell hollered out and said, Hey, Billy! And he stopped with them. He said, Do you know why y'all are out there? You know why you're out there and I'm in here? And Dr. Keller says, No, why? And he said, Because there's more you than there is of me. And Dr. Keller turned around and looked at me and said, And ladies and gentlemen, don't forget it, that is the definition of insanity. And so I just need to tell y'all that if any of y'all come to Kentucky, you'll have the damned accent, you know? There's just more you than there is of me. Anyway, I've been graced to meet a whole bunch of people around the country and other countries, obviously, but now because of the gift of Gab and the beautiful spiritual recovery that I've been able to be given and that I'm able to articulate. And I just love to fly into airports and meet the people. And we had a wonderful ride back from the airport today. It was Doug and Dave and Kevin and myself. And we were talking about how we're going to meet each other, how you just see an alcoholic and you know they're an alcoholic. I mean, they may have been sober 100 years, but you know they're an alcoholic. You know, you dress us up, you clean us up, and we just look like alcoholics. Huh? You can spot us across a bus station, you know, just walking in. And Dave said, Yeah. I said, I didn't know that he would really recognize us when he came in. And Doug looked at him. He said, Right, he's not going to recognize us. He walked in here, three grown men standing right up there looking right on the front row with name tags on the front of their damn shirt. You know? And I thought, Right, I'm a genius, right? Either they're in AA or their mother's sending them on a summer trip, right? Intuition my ass, you know, you just sit there and figure it out, yeah. Anyway, It was a wonderful, wonderful ride back. I don't know that I've enjoyed anything much more than that ride. I'm sure that they may not have because I did most of the talking, but Kevin asked me a question. You just don't ever do that. You just don't ask me a question because I've got an answer. You just hang it up because you're going to get an answer. And it's somewhere in the neighborhood most of the time, you know. But it was just a good trip back, and I'm really happy and glad to be here. Sorry I couldn't get here sooner. I spent 3 days of the longest time of my life last night in Detroit. And nothing wrong with Detroit, but it's a lot of time to be in Detroit when you don't anticipate being in Detroit. You know, the airplane got screwed up, and I was sitting over about halfway. Oh, yeah, if I told you about it, you know, I'd hear half of them would say, gosh, that's tough. And the other half would say, right, yeah. I've been to enough ambulance. But I did have to work the program. Honest to goodness, I really did, because they took us off the plane because it was supposed to have broken down and then started giving us vouchers to spend the night, and they brought a whole bunch of other people in, put them on the plane, and flew them out. About this time, I'm sitting here thinking, I'm sitting here thinking, I believe I'm getting a resentment. You know what I mean? You know, that's why they don't let me carry sharp instruments, I'll tell you that. But the program works. I mean, very seriously, the program works. I'm sitting there. I have decided that what I have to do to rectify this situation is get the president of Northwest Airlines, at least the local Detroit representative, and maybe whoever it is in the world that represents Northwest. I mean, I'm serious. I want somebody that's got some authority because I want to clean their butt right there, you know? But I realized that, number one, there probably wasn't a single soul in that room that really gave a real rat's butt about whether Burns Brady was upset about that flight or not. You know? About the only person that was really getting in real trouble with it was Burns Brady. So I went over to the side and did what we teach each other to do. Sat there and literally prayed about it, inventoried my own resentment about it, looked at what needed to be looked at, went through a 6 and 7 step, didn't have to make any amends to anybody, and I was okay. I really was, and made a move to get into a particular motel that I was supposed to get into. Didn't like that motel, so I had the guy take me back, and I got in a different motel there at the airport, and by 10 o'clock, I'd notified my wife where I was so she wouldn't be terrified. I'd gotten into a wonderful motel room there at the airport. Everything was perfect. I had vouchers to pay for my food. I went right down and sat in the restaurant, and I'm sitting there. I'm 19 years sober. I'm 60 years old, supposed to have some sense. And I'm sitting there, I'm reasonably serene, I mean absolutely on target, not a bit of problem in the world. And the waitress comes up and we get to talking, and I think, this is a real good-looking woman. You know? And you hear it coming, don't you, you know? And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, you know, I'm up here in Detroit, nobody knows me, this woman doesn't know me. I can get me a fifth of whiskey and get that woman up there in that room and we'll have a hell of a time tonight. You know? And I looked around behind me, and I thought, where is that masked man that walked in here and sat down? Because that's incredible. You know, and I mean, I'm serious. I'm sitting here, I've done got the deal done. Done got the card shuffle, got them dealt, and I mean, the players are in place, and I'm ready to roll. And I'm sitting there, I think, no, you better be alcoholic, because if you're not alcoholic, you're crazy as hell. I mean, given the options of the kind of thinking I had, that alcoholism was the best shot I had, you know. Because the rest of it isn't treatable. The rest of it is not treatable. And the alcoholism is because I had a solution. I ate my supper and went upstairs and went to bed and thanked God that I was alone, and that was the way it was. But you say, my God, man, with that kind of recovery, is that the way you think? That's what I'm going to talk about tonight, is the way we think. Now, I'm going to talk about some other things first, because I won't talk about some other things first. But I'm going to get to that in a minute. It's the way we think, because I'm fascinated by it. I'm fascinated by me until I get to know you, now I'm equally fascinated by you. I remember when there was a fellow in Mayfield, in Louisville, when I first came in today. His name was Charlie Robertson. Charlie's dead now, and Charlie was the most spiritual man I've ever known. He's spiritual because he really loved and was grateful for what he had in life. He died with about 27 years of sobriety. Charlie always talked like he had a head full of Valium and a mouth full of mush. But I tell you what, he was wonderful. And Charlie would walk up to me during that first 5 years when I had a sphincter muscle in my rectum about the size that you put a straw through, and I was just like this, and I was rigid as hell, and I was walking around telling everybody what to do, and he'd walk up to me, smile, and say, how you feeling, Burns? I said, I feel fine, Charlie. And he'd say, do you find this program fascinating? I said, yeah, I find it fascinating. He say, that's good, because them that don't find it fascinating seem to get drunk a lot. And then he just turn around and walk off, you know? And I think, who was that? But I am fascinated by this. I get more and more fascinated by this, more and more fascinated by this program as I go along. And that's good, because I love being here. I love alcoholics. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I basically have come to love the world and not be terrified of it most of the time. And even if I am, I've got some way, with your help and with God's grace, to be able to live comfortably in it most of the time. I gave a talk in southern Indiana across the river from Louisville. The river separates the northern part of Kentucky from Indiana. And I mean, literally, it's just a river. And we exchange a lot of AA participation. I go over there. I don't go to many meetings in southern Indiana, but I go there occasionally to talk at birthdays. And in this particular meeting, when I walk in the back door, they know I'm there to talk at a birthday. And I walked in the back door with them and said, hey, Burns, are you talking tonight? And I said, yeah. He said, well, keep it honest and keep it short. And I said, well, I'm not sure I can do both. And he said, then keep it short. Well, I always like to tell this because I'm not, as my experience has grown, and those who've been around AA for a while really do understand that as we've been around a long time, incredible miracles happen. Insights develop. And to try to capsulize that, and I've really tried hard, I'm better at capsulizing it, but I'm still not mature enough in AA to be able to capsulize it down to the seminal message for that day. And so I try to keep it as short as I can, but sometimes it gets away from me, and I don't do that to prepare you, because you can get up and leave anytime you want to. I'm going to finish the story whether you're all gone or not. Because the whole deal is, some of y'all may need to hear it, but every time I tell it, I'm fascinated by it, because I need to hear it over and over, because I'm the man sitting in Detroit trying to take a waitress to bed, so I need to hear this thing a lot of times. What it will be is honest. And what I need to tell you is that I don't mean to preach and teach. Somewhere in this talk, I'll get to preaching and teaching. I don't apologize for it anymore, because there are preachers and teachers in my life since I got into AA. If they hadn't come into my life, I'd either be drunk or crazy. And I get to that point, and sometimes I'll even recognize it, and I'll even identify it, and I'll say it to you. I'm getting ready to preach or teach, or I'm right in the middle of it. But one thing I found about alcoholics, we may not have opinions on a lot of things, but we draw damn strong conclusions, you know? And a lot of that stuff will come out tonight, because a lot of things have happened in my life. A lot of things I'm able to identify in my life that happened before I was an active alcoholic and drug addict, and a lot of things have happened since I've had the grace and been given the privilege to come into recovery. I was talking in Knoxville, Tennessee, at the Tennessee State Conference three months ago, and one of the speakers there was Peggy M. from Nebraska. And Peggy was telling this story, and the story was that when she first got sober, and she's been sober about 30-something years and has a wonderful program. I love Peggy as a person, and I love to hear her story. It's a good, solid AA story. And she was talking about when she first got sober, they lived in an area where it's kind of out in the backwoods, and she was so confused and screwed up when she first got sober, she just knew she didn't want to drink and she wanted to go to meetings, but she would just kind of do things to keep her busy. And she would go out in the winter, that first winter, and she would put out food for the wild animals. And the foxes would come up and eat the food. And she noticed that the mother fox came up, or the adult fox came up first, and then it would bring the cubs. And then when the spring came, she was a lot clearer, the program was a lot stronger, she felt a lot better, but she still continued this practice. And she would go out and set up the food, and she went out one day and set it up, and as she turned around to walk inside the house, she just felt something. And she turned and she said about 5 feet behind her, this fox had come up and was sitting with its feet out in front of it, with its back legs drawn up under it, and was looking straight at her. Is this thing feeding back? Is that what it's doing? I didn't figure you'd need it for me that much. I don't have a bit of problem screaming. Is that now? I'm not going to talk till he gets it fixed. You know, see what it just can't keep from it, can I? Testing 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, I think. So the fox would sit there with its feet, with the legs out in the front of the fox, just like this, with the back legs drawn up underneath the fox. Is that better now? With the back legs drawn up underneath the fox. And she said, I turned around and looked at this fox, and the fox was looking right at me about 5 feet away from me. And she said, I just knew, looking in that fox's eyes, that fox was saying, thank you for saving my babies. And as I listened to that story, and I've done a lot of hunting, Al. We talked about that. I've done a lot of hunting. And I've seen dogs sit like that all the time. I've seen wild animals come up and do that all the time. So that's not unique. That is not a unique act for a wild animal to do that. And the fact of the matter is, in all probability, what that animal's doing is coming up there to eat, but it's watching you because the trust isn't there. But enough time has elapsed that they don't think anything's going to happen, but they're not really doing anything but watching you. Now, that's the logical, scientific answer for what that animal's doing. What Peggy saw was an animal with a look in its eye that said, "Thank you for saving my life." And I realized that she said that the miracle of recovery for me has been, and for each of us, has been, it's not the change in what we see. It's the change in how we see it. And as I thought about my life in recovery, that's the miracle. Sure, there have been, and I will describe some incredible miracles in my life that defy logic. But for most of the time, my life today, as far as out there in that world and all the challenges and all the things that I don't understand about man's inhumanity to man and why do bad things happen to good people, what I see hasn't changed. What has changed is how I see it. And that's the miracle of recovery. And as this story unfolds, I hope that theme stays there, because when I close this talk, I will give you an example of probably the most dramatic thing that's ever happened in my life that was a change in how I saw it. As I begin to think about the miracles, the miracle of recovery, the miracle of how I think, I begin to think about probably the greatest miracle that I've known in my life, the greatest miracle that may have happened in history, occurred in May of 1935. Now, see, I don't know anything about virgin births, and I don't know anything about resurrections. I have chosen to commit myself to believing that those things really happened. I've chosen to believe that. I'm very much at peace with it. But I don't know anything about virgin births nor resurrections. What I know about is drinking whiskey and alcoholism. And what I know is what happened in May of 1935 in Akron, Ohio, can't happen. It's not possible. There is no way it's possible. Here's a man that has come down to Akron, Ohio. He's lost everything he's got. He's a screaming drunk with about five and a half months of sobriety. He's getting ready to cut a deal, which is really shady as hell. He's really walking close to being illegal, if not immoral and unethical. He ain't got a pot to pee in or a window to throw it out of. He ain't got a cent. He can't even pay for his hotel room. This whole deal is the deal to bring him back. He's a drunk with 5.5 months sobriety. Think about it. 5.5 months of sobriety? I remember what I was at 5.5 months sobriety. Finding the commode was a real chore. And finding it on time was marginal, you know? And let me tell you, I can give you an instance for that. It's absolutely true. It makes good. It's humorous, but I can tell you a real instance. You don't want to even hear that one, but that's the way it was. 5.5 months in sobriety. And he has just tried this deal, and the deal has collapsed. Not only are they not going to sign the deal, they're real close to suing him, except he didn't have anything. And he's got to figure out how to get out of that hotel and get back home, and he's lost it all. 5.5 months sobriety. And he walks right up to the crossroads, literally in his life, at the crossroads in that hotel, and there's the bar, and there's a list of churches. There's no AA meetings. There are no sponsors. The closest thing's the Oxford Movement. They don't have this deal where they've got meetings just for drunks. They don't have this deal where they've got sponsors for one-on-one type telephone calls. And there he stands. And he hears the glasses. And he hears the drums. And he's busted. Ego shot. Nerve shot. 5.5 months sobriety. And he goes and makes a telephone call. Is that a miracle? You make up your own mind. But because of that miracle, we're sitting here tonight. Because of that miracle, there are 400 meetings a week in Louisville, Kentucky. You know, within 5 minutes, if I can't figure out whether I'm mad at my wife because she didn't kiss me right last night, and I mean, it ain't no big deal like I'm going to lose the farm, I can be 10 minutes away from meeting and exactly 30 seconds away from a telephone call to my sponsor. And even that's a miracle that I do that. As I become increasingly more involved in this program, in other words, as my sobriety and my maturity has gone along, have recognized with increasing gratitude and increasing responsibility, wanting to be sure that that newcomer that comes in that back door, or that individual with 15 or 20 years of sobriety, because I've made, I don't know how many 12-step calls on people with more than 30 years of sobriety who got drunk, but people with over 20 years of sobriety got drunk. You know, they forgot that we only got today, as you were talking, Dave, when we were sitting there, we only got today. They forgot that. And so it's not just the newcomer, it's any of us along on this journey of insanity that we can get into because of the way we think and because of all the stuff that goes on. It's a big package called alcoholism. And I have become increasingly aware of wanting to be sure that message that was recorded by those people when it started in its simplicity stays that simple if it comes out of my mouth. Because most alcoholics like me, they can screw up a one-car parade. You know, and keeping it simple when it comes out of my... I was in a meeting not too long ago, sitting in there in my home group. It's a men's meeting. And one of the guys in there, one of the newcomers said, I think I have this feeling where I hate my wife, and y'all tell me it's a resentment, and I just hate her. And he went through some stuff that it was... Maybe he should have had a little bit of disgust about the deal, but, you know... He hated her. What was he going to do? And somebody, he said, that's a resentment. Tell me what to do. And everybody talked. And he said, every time I get a resentment, he said, I've got this oak tree out behind my house. He said, I go out there and I start running around that oak tree. And I run around and I run around and I run around and run around. And finally, I just get so tired, I fall down. And I'm so tired, I just go in and go to bed. My resentment's gone. Somebody said, what about the next day? He said, it's always back. So I go out there and I run around that oak tree. So I run around that oak tree. And I thought, man, he's going to kill himself. And he's going to die, and he's going to be pissed about the whole deal, you know, when he dies. He's going to be angry at his wife, and angry at that oak tree, and angry at himself, and the whole deal's going to be there. About 2 weeks later, I was in a meeting, and somebody said that he had a resentment, and asked what went on. Somebody else raised his hand and said, well, my therapist said that if I get down there and I write down why I hate this person, and he said, I have to do this because if I'm ever going to have any self-esteem, I've got to stand up for my values and what I really am inside. So I have to write this stuff down about what they've done to disgrace me. And so then after I finish it, I seal it, I mail it to them. And I'm sitting there, I thought, well, the newcomer now figures the way to deal with resentment is write a hate letter and run around an oak tree, you know? Now, I got to tell you, I'm not anti-oak trees and I'm not anti-therapy. But what I'm anti is that newcomer hearing that that's the resolution to a resentment. And as AA, by the grace of God, continues to get bigger and bigger and bigger, what I see is more and more craziness. Now, that's to be anticipated because we didn't come in here with our deck full, right? And you got some of us who are absolutely intent on telling you whatever it is we're feeling, whether it has anything to do with the truth or not. We're just going to tell you, and we're going to tell it as the truth. So this preservation of this integrity is important to me. Because when I came in AA, I came in AA in 1977. I got sober December the 1st, 1977. God, you know, enabled me to take a shotgun out of my mouth and crawl and ask for help. And I've been sober ever since then by the grace of God and working my butt off. That's exactly how I got sober. And when I came in AA in 1977, it's what I call the dark ages in AA in Louisville, Kentucky. And the reason I call it that is because when I came in, the credo was don't drink, go to meetings, get a sponsor, tell him everything that's wrong with you. He'll tell you exactly what you ought to do about it. Then you go do it and then go help a drunk. And that was AA. And I mean, I was ready. I would listen to anybody. I came in teachable, and I hooked into that sucker just like that. Got me a good sponsor, and he was one of the best sponsors I've ever had, and I've had three now. And he was wonderful, exactly what God gave me. And I'd tell him everything. Jim was older and smarter and tougher, and he'd just tell me what to do, and I'd go do it and feel good about it, and then I'd go save a drunk. I mean, I literally became a lethal weapon for God around that day. I mean, here he comes. You better have to drink a beer because he's going to take you to treatment anyway. It don't matter whether you've had a beer or not. Here he comes. Now, I got to tell you, there are two things kept me sober during that period of time, and I did that for 9 years. For 9 years, I had a 3 1/3-step program, the first 3 1/3 of the 10th step. I had that first 3 wired, and I had 1/3 of the 10th step wired. And the two things that kept me sober during that time was working with newcomers, because I was constantly in trenches, kept me out of my own self-centered stuff. And the other thing was that I was absolutely convinced, because alcohol whipped me. Alcohol whipped me. When I came into AA, I didn't come here as a pleasant thought to get away from a bad habit. I came in here because it was killing me and it didn't work. When I came into AA, the only thing that worked about alcohol was it would stop the diarrhea, the sweating, and the stomach cramps and keep me out of DTs, but it didn't stop the committee. It didn't stop the thinking, and it didn't stop the feelings. It didn't stop anything except stop the shakes for a little while. So, you know, big hero that I don't drink anymore, I don't drink because it didn't work. I put up with a lot of shaking and a lot of going into DTs for a long time because there was still a payoff, but one day the payoff wasn't as bad as the payback. And I don't mean losing cars and losing wives and losing profession. That went a long time ago. Not that I lost them. The concern about it left a long time ago. At that point in time, it did not work. My hat is off to anybody who quits drinking when it still works. My hat is off to anybody who comes in this program. People do it. I've made a ton of 12-step calls on people who came in because they thought they were going to lose something, whatnot, and they stuck and they've made it and they've got good solid recovery because the insight developed. But they'll still tell me that it still worked. And maybe it did. But it didn't for me. But two things kept me sober. Whiskey whipped me, alcohol whipped me, and working with newcomers. Working with newcomers. But about 9 years in the program, I was goofier than a goat. I mean, all these people that I went out and got and dragged in and stayed in the program, they all kind of wandered away from me. And I began to notice they seemed to be happy, joyous, and free and doing a lot of good stuff. And I was still crazy. Jumping out of cars at red lights when they turned green, they'd honk, and I'd be back there in their face with my finger right in their nose saying, "You son of a bitch." Now, I'll tell you what 9 years of sobriety did for me. It got me to have enough sense to look in the rearview mirror, and if it was a great big guy, I didn't go out and get in his face. It was a little bitty old woman. I was right in her face. I just didn't hurt it, you know. So I got smarter even... I mean, I had to think about this. My sponsor said, "You were a bully." Yeah, you know, but I was a smart bully, you know. But I did all those crazy things, 9 years in the program. And driven to my knees by a series of events, which are the ultimate in self-centeredness. My wife, we'd been married 2 years, or we'd been going together for 2 years, and my first wife kicked me out, and I may not get to that. She kicked me out when I finally made her so mad. She ran me off, you know, and I said, "It's your fault you kicked me out of the house. Drunks are wonderful. We piss everybody off, and they kick us out, and we blame it on them. We do it time and time again. You know, we're just good at that. You know, all these were victims. My first wife kicked me out. I ran into Casey, and she was wonderful. She's wonderful then. She's wonderful today. One of the most wonderful people I've ever met. And everywhere I go, she says, "Tell them I love them," and she means it. Some of you may think I'm wonderful, may even love me, but I don't even, I'm a good guy with a lot of good characteristics, and I'm dead set carrying God's message, but when you meet my wife, you've met the best. And that's just an absolute truth. She, you know, she don't walk on water, but every now and then when I think she could if she knew where the stumps were, because she really is a delightful lady. But she says, "Tell everybody she loves when I get there." I almost always forget it, but it just dawned on me to tell you all that. But she was really a neat lady, and she quit drinking when I quit drinking. She went to Al-Anon for 6 months, and then she, or 6 years, and then went into AA, and now she's in AA and Al-Anon both. And 9 years into recovery, and I had Casey, all alcoholics take hostages. You know, we take hostages, and my hostage was my wife. I mean, I was a benevolent dictator. I gave her everything in the world. All I expected back was for her to give me everything in the world. It was a hell of a good relationship when everybody did that by the rules. And about 9 years in sobriety, she came to me and said, "Burns," said, "I want to go back to college." She said, "I've never loved you more, but I want to go back to college. I want to start going to my own meetings." Well, see, I took her to our meetings. We prayed together in the morning. Nothing bad about what we did. It just had to be done the way I outlined it. And most of you would have been happy to have been married to me because I was a benevolent dictator. You would go wonderful places. You'd have lovely clothes. You'd be treated like a princess. So long as you did it my way. You know? And I mean, that's every way. And I mean, I put her right there on my hip, and she came and said, "Burns, I've never loved you more." She said, I want to go back to college. I want to start going to my own meetings, and I want to go into some therapy. And what I heard was, "I'm leaving you." And in my self-centeredness, the only solution to a woman who ain't playing by the rules is what? Get another woman. Seems obvious to me, doesn't it? I mean, why doesn't it seem obvious? None of the guys will talk because their wives are with them. They say... And the wives are all saying, "Get that heretic out of here. He's going to change our men," you know. I mean, but that's, you know. And maybe some didn't affect some of you that way, but certainly the ones I've ever talked to did, and so that was exactly my resolution. Now, I had a job description for women that came from my mother, and it really did. And the job description for women was what my mother did for me. My mother always took care of me and made me feel special. And so I just automatically assumed that's what all women are supposed to do. And my job description for any woman was take care of me and make me feel special. And when you didn't fit the job description, you're out and I got another woman. I didn't know all that. That's just what I did. I know it today because it's called 4 steps and 5 steps and 6 steps and 7 steps and 8 steps and 9 steps. And as Wilson said, sometimes it takes therapy to even find out where the bullets are coming from, you know? It really does. And by the grace of God and using all that, I have some insight in that. But what happened was, at 9 years in sobriety, Casey did that, and I said, I'm going to get me another woman, but y'all had given me enough AA to know that I was going to break the rules. And I knew I couldn't break the rules. Rules like honesty and dignity and not hurting people. Strange rules, huh? Strange rules. Anybody says AA doesn't have rules? Read Silkworth's story. He calls them rules. And they're absolutely rules for me. Wilson called them suggestions. He called them suggestions because the other 99 people said you won't get any drunks come here if you tell them the rules. So he brokered the deal and he just said, I'll give suggestions everywhere else. I'm going to say directions. And Silkworth called them rules. In any event, by that series of events, I was driven to my knees because I was in total conflict with the way I felt and the way that I thought. That's when I first found out that feelings are always to be acknowledged, they're never to be trusted, because it felt absolutely appropriate for me to go out and get another woman. And the one was my nurse. I was in practice at that time, and we were in an office with 6 doctors. We had a nurse that worked with us, I mean, that close every minute of every day. Been with this woman for 2 years, quality lady. She'd been divorced from her husband, and all of a sudden, she needed me in her life. And it was on the verge of being consummated, and I knew it was completely out of whack. And I sat with a new sponsor and had to have some therapy and really got... What actually happened at that time was a little pigeon that I was sponsoring with 7 months of sobriety. When a student's ready, the teacher in this program will always arrive. And this little pigeon gave me 8 tapes, and they were Joe and Charlie's tapes of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. As I listened to those tapes, I became aware of the program that I didn't have. And from that time, my whole life turned around. Today, I have a 12-step program. And I got to tell you, the difference between 12 steps and 3 steps is the difference in daylight and dark. And most of the people who come up to me and say, Burns, I just don't think I can get this. I just didn't seem to work. I feel miserable, you know. Get off your ass and work. You know, that's just all there is to it. Just get off your ass and work. At least in most instances, most people just simply haven't done the work. They've got the spiritual part right. They haven't got the work part right. And in actual fact, what I came to know is that spirituality without work is not spirituality. Bill Wilson defined it as humility and responsibility. And my responsibility is to do the work. End of it is what God gets. First part of it's my part. I've got to do that work, and y'all taught me how to do it. As I got to this book, and I read this book, and I got that sucker, and did what was in the book, and 6 or 8 of us got together and started our first big book study. And I go to 5 meetings, anywhere from 3 to 5 meetings, always 3, and usually 5 meetings a week. And 2 of those meetings are always big book studies. As I opened that book and went through it, I found, and it continued to enlarge on me, and I became more and more intrigued, and I really became intrigued by it about 2 years ago. Wilson says our problem is not alcohol. And I read that, you know, and let me say something about that. As I've already told you, I'm a doctor. Not only am I a doctor, I'm a specialist in the field of addiction. I run the Kentucky Impaired Physicians Program, and I'm the addictionist for a 200-man homeless shelter. I've worked with thousands of alcoholics. And everybody in this room knows as much about alcoholism as I do, except you can't draw the formulas. Now, the reason I've learned to draw the formulas is so I can teach doctors how to treat us. And for that new person who's just come in here, I want to tell you, if you're an alcoholic of my type, no matter how spiritual you get, you'll never be able to drink alcohol like a normal person. You're playing 2 sandwiches short of a picnic in regard to being able to drink whiskey like a normal person. Okay? So I want to be sure that nobody here... I heard this doctor from Kentucky who's been sober 19 years come up and say, our problem's not alcohol, so I think I'll go drink some, you know? It's not like, well, we have this allergy. I do. If you're an alcoholic of my type, you got it. But I was fascinated that Wilson says our problem's not alcohol. Our problem is our thinking. My problem is my mind. And if you don't believe that, sitting in Detroit, I guarantee you, every male, I work with 99% with men. You say, my God, I can see why, but I work 99% with men. And there's a lot of reasons, and that's not all particularly my issue. I can promise you that. And all men have a peculiar mental twist. Now, I got to believe the women do, because Casey describes me, and she sponsors a lot of people, and they come in and trust me and talk with me, and I hear the same peculiar mental twist. The values will change as to what they put in their priorities as opposed to men, but it's still this peculiar mental twist. If you read the book, he talks it, that precedes the drinking, the peculiar mental twist. And I got to thinking about, and my mind's real analytical, and I thought, he never really describes that. What does he mean? As the years have unfolded, I've come to know exactly, at least for this day, what it means to me. I was talking in Beaumont, Texas, about 5 years ago, and I had a conference, and the voice of the conference was named Damon. Damon, at that time, was 85 years old, been sober 45 years. And Damon talked like he had a flat brainwave. But if you'd listen to him, this guy was humorous and brilliant. And I got right down on the front row, because I really listened to those guys. They got stuff to say that we're going to miss them when they're gone. I love the newcomer, but this stuff that comes from the wisdom of those people is incredible. And I got up there, and Damon told this wonderful joke. He said, now this is an alcoholic joke. He said, there was a traveling salesman who used to travel all over East Texas. And he was, like we say in Mayfield, bad to drink. I was born and raised in Mayfield. In fact, we used to say something like that was bad to drink. So this guy would check into a motel, and he'd go out that night and get drunk, and he would come back in, and they'd have him set up like they normally did to keep his business, and he'd work there for a week, go to the next town, work for a week, go to the next town for a week. Finally, one day, he's like a lot of us, he'd had about all his fun he could tolerate, so he went home and got into AA. Or went to a treatment center, did something, came back 30 days later, and he's not drinking anymore, but they don't know that. He checks into the motel, and that night he goes out to an AA meeting, and they set him up like they normally do, and he comes back in, opens the door, flips on the light, and there beside the bed, there's a big fifth of whiskey, and on the side, a tub of ice. And on the foot of the bed are sitting two beautiful women. And he looks at that scene for a minute, and he says, well, he said, I quit drinking and gone to AA, and I asked them what I got to do to stay sober and be happy. And they told me I had to quit drinking and change everything I'm doing. So I can't drink that whiskey. And one of you girls is going to have to leave. That's an alcoholic joke. I mean, that's it. He had half of it right. You know, he had half of it right. The first part of the peculiar mental twist to me is being bigger than the rules. Being bigger than the rules. First half of the peculiar mental, or the first part of the peculiar mental twist is being bigger. See, I can drive down in a 65 mile an hour speed zone, I'll go 90 miles an hour. Because the rules don't fit for me. Now, they fit for you, Dave. They fit for you, Doug. And if I'm sponsoring y'all, I'm going to sit there and point out your self-centeredness but not following the rules. And after I've given you this wonderful solution, well, I'm going to get in the car and drive home 75 to 90 miles an hour because the rules don't fit for me. I'm going to jump in and drive in handicapped parking areas because I'm just going to be there 5 minutes and I'll get out and get away and nobody will need to use it. It's not a matter of trying to fool anybody. They just won't need it that long. Now, with the IRS, it's not a matter of income tax evasion. It's a matter of income tax avoidance. You know? So it's not illegal, but it still sucks. You know, I know it. And when I got in this program, y'all screwed that part up for me. But I still think, I'm in Detroit, income tax, handicapped parking zones, speed limits, heart attacks. Had a heart attack 2 years ago, nearly died. Still won't do my exercise. I'm going to do it the next time I have another heart attack, you know? But I'll con myself because I'm eating right. So I get half the damn story right, you know? I'm going to eat right, but I'm not going to get around to exercise because I dodged that bullet. And that peculiar mental twist in this area, what's the obvious thing? One day, if I don't do everything you've taught me to do, what I'm going to talk about what you taught me to do, I'm going to begin to believe it's okay to take that woman to bed in Detroit. I'm going to believe it's okay to screw the IRS. I'm going to believe it's okay to park in handicapped parking zone, and I'm going to believe it's okay to drink whiskey. Because what's the difference? It's all part of the scheme to be bigger than the rules. 6 months ago, I have this cyclical depression. Now, Wilson had this, and most of you knew it. Well, I've come to know that Bill Wilson did have cyclical depression, and I really do have these mood swings. And I really know in my own soul that they're more than normal mood swings. I also know that if I work my program the way y'all taught me to work my program, those mood swings are tolerable. I know what a whipping I've taken from drugs and alcohol, and I'm telling my story. If any of y'all are taking medication, this is not meant for you. I ain't preaching and teaching about this part. I'm just sharing with you what I've concluded. When I work my program, those mood swings are not that bad. When Wilson had his worst depressions, if you look at what he did, and this is very much an opinion on my part, Wilson had depressions significantly for prolonged periods of time when he didn't work his program. And he's just like us. He wrote the book, but he didn't walk on water. He's one of my heroes, but he ain't got wings. And when he didn't work the program, he got depressed. And there were times in Wilson's life when he didn't work the program that he gave us, just like any other drunk. And I was sitting home about 6 months ago, and I was in a depression. Now, when I get into one of these things, I get a bunker mentality. I pull everything down over my head just like that, and nobody comes in. And by God, I'll tell you, those who've gotten to know me, they don't want to come in either. You know? And I used to do it because I knew they would scream at me, and I didn't want them even beginning to take my inventory. Now I do it because I don't want to hurt anybody. I got in this program because I was tired of hurting people. Probably the thing that got me here most of all was not saving my life. It was because I was tired of screwing over other people, and I left a swath behind me this wide, and I'm no exception. But I got tired of looking at the blood from the people that I loved and that loved me dearly, and I cut them in half. And I finally got to where I couldn't stand that. And when I get in this depression, nobody's sacred, and I'll just pull it down. It usually lasts about 24 to 48 hours, and I get like that, and I'm just frozen. I was laying in the bed. It was Saturday morning. It was about 8 o'clock, and Casey had gotten up, and she'd gotten ready. She goes to her AA meeting on Saturday morning and then goes to an Al-Anon meeting after that. And she has a good program, I mean a solid program in both. And she walked over and sat down beside me and just looked at me. And this was a risk. She's about the only one that can do this. Maybe my sponsor, but I'm not even sure he could. She looked at me and she said, "You know how much I love you." And I looked at her. I never say anything under those conditions. I just looked at her. And she said, "You know how much I love you." And I said, "Yes." I didn't say anything. I just looked at her. And she said, "So I'm going to tell you something that you need to hear no matter what you may think." She said, "Burns, you've gotten bigger than the program." And I listened to her and I thought, how could she say this? If y'all walked with me on a daily basis, you'd think this guy must be God's true emissary. Because what you hear from this podium, with the exception of some bullshit, most of it's absolutely true. You know? And I mean, I really walk it and I talk it and I'm there. I'm on the firing line for God because I care that drunks don't die drunk. And I'm saying, and if I told you what I did, you'd say, "Give him a star. He's a hero." I mean, this is the kind of life I lead in AA. And I'm thinking, how can she say I'm bigger than the program? I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Burns, you haven't called your sponsor in 6 months." Bingo. Did I think about not calling him? No. But did I think about calling him? No. Wilson called this self-centeredness. And it's as much a part of Burns Brady as breathing. And the part today is, I can handle it. And I got 19 years, 60 years old, doctor, I ought to have some sense. But it's just one short step to that delusion that says, I can handle it. And even if I don't say it, that's the way I act. And you make the problem tougher, I just try harder. And the harder I try, the more isolated I get, because I get bigger than the rule. What I looked at on that was it was time to get another sponsor. There's nothing wrong with my sponsor. But I knew intuitively, how to handle things that used to baffle us, that Jack and I had really traveled different roads. He's got a great program. I have a great program. It was time for another relationship. And I knew that and did not have the honesty, because of the fear, to go sit and talk with Jack, who's been my sponsor for the last 9 years, and say, "Jack, I need to get another sponsor." Not because you're doing anything wrong. We live on different sides of town. We go to different meetings. We don't see each other that much. And I need to be, there's some things I needed. It wasn't that he wasn't giving them to me. It just didn't work. and God knew it was time to move on. But I couldn't deal with that. Had never even thought about it. And I got a new sponsor, and now I meet with him every Tuesday for lunch. We attend two meetings together and have for some time. He came in the program the same time I did, and my life's a lot more sane. To help me deal with the self-centeredness. Did I stop praying? No. Did I stop working the steps? No. But I just moved away. I became almost my own higher power in dealing with real world 101. Prayed every morning, prayed throughout the day, but forgot to use God's missionaries. I became the missionary. Second part of the peculiar mental twist is what I call victimization. If it weren't for them, this wouldn't be happening. I mean, I became a supreme victim for 5 minutes in the Detroit airport on the way down here. They have screwed me. You know? I mean, and I can take it back. See, it's more subtle today because they really did screw me, you know? There was truth in that. When I first came in this program, it was, if it weren't for my mother, and there was some truth in that, if it weren't for my daddy, you know, not that I would have been an alcoholic, but they screwed up some of my thinking. Absolutely. Tell me. I mean, when I was 10 years old, my daddy came up to me. My daddy's one of the most wonderful people on earth. He taught me what he learned. I'm 10 years old. Daddy comes to say to me, Burnsmack, I need to talk to you. And I said, yes, sir. We go out and sit on the porch. He said, you're having some headaches now. And I said, yes, sir. He said, I remember when I started having headaches, Papa Brady came and talked to me and told me that I'd reached the age where I was going to start playing with myself. And he said, Papa Brady told me if I did that I'd go crazy. And I need to tell you, that's what's going to happen. And I'm sitting there 10 years old going, oh, my God, I need to go to that one. So you think that doesn't have an impact on you? Yeah. And you come in day 8 and say, don't worry about your family of origin. Don't worry about that. That's what we got for. Sure, we worry about it because that's a part of it. It didn't make me a drunk. But boy, I mean, I hung into that sucker for years. That if my daddy had told me the truth, I wouldn't have everything from premature ejaculation to anxiety over there. I mean, there it was, you know. And the bottom line is, I wouldn't be a drunk. It's their fault, you know. And we were poor. I mean, yeah, we were poor. I couldn't belong to the country club. I had to caddy. And by God, I'd walk down that fairway and see them little rich wimps dive in that swimming pool. I'm thinking, oh, I hate their guts. If I hadn't been poor, I had to work when I went to college. You know, Daddy couldn't afford to send me, so I had to work. And that's why I'm a drunk. Daddy couldn't pay me through college. And I married that rich bitch that I married because she had money. I wouldn't have married her if Daddy had money. I mean, I had it all. And then when you get sober, it gets more subtle, like they screwed me in the Detroit area. But it's always there, just one short step to victimization. Now, Wilson knew we wouldn't understand victimization. What would we understand? Resentment. He made it work. I could understand it. How do you feel? Oh, I resent that. Okay, now we got a shot at it. You know? When you're over here wondering what it is and you're blaming everything, you ain't got a shot. Now you got a shot. You don't want to drink any more whiskey, right? Then you hate these people, right? That's called a resentment. What are you going to do it? You're going to do an inventory and you're going to pray about it. You're going to share it with somebody. You're going to let God take it away. And then you're going to go out and tell these people that screwed over you that you're sorry. You know, I'm sitting there looking for the guy who runs the airport for the Northwest trying to say, I'm really sorry that I hate your guts, you know? But at least I had the right idea, didn't I? Resentment. Then the last part of the peculiar mental twist for me is what I call the square peg, round hole, bigger hammer syndrome, you know? I mean, if I've got a problem and that square peg won't fit in that round hole, I'll do the alcoholic solution. Get the bigger hammer and just beat hell out of it till it finally fits. And if I work hard enough, I'll make that sucker fit. I can't get it back out, but I've got it where it fits, you know? And when I got in this program, y'all took me, y'all, some people call it control, but to make it the program, it goes to the second half of the first step. It's called the manageability of life. Every alcoholic I've ever known who got drunk, who really made it to this program, whether it's been 1 week or 30 years,
really did know that they were powerless over alcohol. We have a wonderful way of diagnosing alcoholism in the medical profession. We do these evaluations, and there's one evaluation called the Michigan Alcohol Standardization Test, and it's 25 questions. 25 questions, and you get a score for each one of these questions as far as your answer. And there's one question, and if you get 5 points, then you're an alcoholic. And they assign a score to each question. And one of the questions is, have you ever been to an AA meeting? And if the answer is yes, that's 5 points by itself. Hell of a deal, isn't it? I mean, it's intuitively obvious. There ain't a soul in here saying, you know, I'm not doing anything on Saturday night. Let's run down here and hear this AA talking, you know? Can't think of, you know, why not? Sure, it beats going to a movie or running around catching fish. Let's go listen to a drunk.
Right.
You know? Anybody in this meeting saying, I hope to God they find out what's wrong with me and fix it. So most people, nobody gets drunk over the first half of the first step. They get drunk over the second half of the first step. The manageability of life. Now, you say that's my opinion. It's my opinion based on tons of experience in the attempts to manage life. And I got to tell you, that's impossible. That's impossible. And Wilson said, why will these people have such an incredible necessity to control and manage life? He said, I know what it is. It's called fear. If I can't handle it, it's going to eat my lunch. All of my life, every morning when I got up, even as a little boy, what I felt in the pit of my stomach was a hole you could drive a truck through. When I got into AA for a number of years in AA, every morning I'd wake up and you could drive a truck through the hole in my gut. Because my thought was, when my feet hit this floor, somewhere between now, either in the shower I'm going to take or tonight before I go to bed, something's going to be around that corner, and when I turn it, it's going to laugh at me, take my lunch pail, kick my ass, and send me home crying. And I got to tell you, if I don't stay right between the curbs with this 12-step program, it does it today just like that. Wilson said, what is fear? It's the fear of the failure of my own self-reliance, that I can't handle it. And I drank tons of whiskey and took tons of dope over trying to handle it. The only solution for this peculiar mental twist, victimization, resentment, bigger than the rules, self-centeredness, square peg, round hole, bigger hammer syndrome, absolute fear that just destroys me. The only answer for those is what you taught me, and that's spiritual. And when I came into AA, y'all told me that, and I thought, man, I've been deacon in 5 churches. I've had 8.5 years of psychiatric therapy. I know it's spiritual, but what does that mean? And then I heard this group that would stand here on one side and say, you just turn everything over to God. You know, there's this group that will sit there and be in an AA meeting, they got a 16-year-old kid, and they'll say, my kid was out drunk last night shooting dope, ran over a fire plug, whipped 2 cops, and God's got grandchildren, so I'll just have to turn him over to God. And I'm sitting there thinking, you idiot! Turn him over to God, and he's 16, and here's this other group over here that says, I'll tell you what we need to do. We need to put the little SOB in a prison. He'll never get straight unless we put him in jail. You know, we're going to handle it all. And I thought somewhere between turning everything over to God and doing everything myself is the answer. And the rest of this whole journey has been figuring out how that answer works. Now, I've got to tell you, it's not really complicated. There are 3 parts to spirituality for me. One is a sponsor. I've never been without a sponsor. I had one first one for the first 9 years, the next one for the second 9 years, and this third one for about 6 months. And each one of these men have been distinctly different, and they came in my life, and as I look back over it, it is absolutely impossible to have manufactured what God put in my life with each of these men who are vastly different, but my needs at each of these points was vastly different. I needed a hero, a role model, and somebody I could follow, and I had different needs at each of those areas. Sure, I needed to quit drinking, but there were different levels of craziness in my recovery at those different times. The second part is meetings. Meetings have become absolutely something I love. And you and I both know that when someone relapses, you go ask them about what happened, and they'll tell you, and invariably they quit going to meetings. Not every time, nothing's 100%, but almost invariably they quit going to meetings. So I began to look at what meetings mean for me in this program. First thing, when I came into the program, I had sawdust for brains. I literally couldn't walk, talk, and chew gum. I mean, I couldn't read the big book at that time. I couldn't read the Courage Journal. I couldn't read a meditation book. I mean, I literally had such a wet brain, and Wilson described a wet brain in his story, just classical for what mine was. We today call it the post-acute recovery syndrome. Short-term memory for recent events, sleep, pattern, simple problem-solving, stress management, screwed up for 6 months to 2 years. We're playing literally with sawdust for brains. Literally with sawdust for brains. So when I came in this program, I started going to meetings right off. My sponsor said, go to meetings. So boy, I mean, I was going to meetings. And what I found out about going to meetings is this is a perfect program composed of an awful lot of goofy people. And on a given night, tonight I'm telling my story, and y'all expect me to have some insights into some truths, and I do. And what I found out about AA is tonight's guru may not be able to pick his nose without threatening his brain tomorrow night. So we change gurus on a daily basis. I mean, that's exactly what we do. We change these people who at that particular point in time are between the spiritual curves. And contrary to what you may think, and I think some of you may, and I'm being about halfway facetious, I am okay tonight. Let's not take a vote on that, but I am okay tonight. I am okay tonight. But I found it's a perfect program composed of an awful lot of goofy people. When I first came in the program, people were hitting on my wife. And if you met my wife, she's a cute young lady. And I really didn't appreciate it, but I understood it. There were people trying to get me in bed, and that was totally confusing to me because I looked like the wrath of God. And I'm serious. I had little bitty legs, little bitty arms, big pot belly. I had acne on my face from the alcohol, and I couldn't even think and walk straight. But people were trying to get me in bed. There were people who wanted to borrow money and didn't tend to pay it back, and they didn't. And I got real confused. I mean, if this is a program based on honesty and this is supposed to be everybody wanting to stay sober, why is this craziness going on? And then I began to ask people who want to take me out to have a cup of coffee. I said, why do you want to take me out to have a cup of coffee? And they said, because we want to stay sober and we want to help you stay sober. And I found the winners. And if you're new in this program, find the winners. Don't expect us to walk on water, because those of us who reach that point to be winners, we know we don't walk on water. We're just here to carry you a message, and we've been doing it a little longer than you have. But find the winners, the people who talk the big book, the people who talk the steps, the people who talk giving rather than receiving, the people who know that to receive is to give, all the things that are spiritual concepts, that are spiritual values, that are absolutely the cornerstone of it, find the winner. I found out by going to meetings, them that don't go to meetings don't hear what happens to them that don't go to meetings. I also found out when I read there is a solution, it says there will come a day when we'll be unable to bring into our conscious memory with sufficient force the humiliation of a week or a month ago. We literally forget what happens. Isn't God wonderful to give us the type of memory that will allow us to forget pain, but gives us this program so we can walk in this door and be reminded gently and humorously of every minute of that pain and be given a solution for it? When I walk in the back door of that room tonight, I immediately know what I am. I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. Every AA meeting I walk into, the first thing that I know in my memory is I'm an alcoholic. How to identify myself? I'm Burns Brady. I'm an alcoholic. The people who don't understand say, isn't that demeaning? No, it's reminding. Because we're taught we'll forget, and we will forget. Isn't it wonderful to be able to forget pain? But thank God we've got a home to come to that we can be reminded of it and be given a solution for it. Of course, this is where my friends are. This is where the miracles happen. This is where the change in thinking occurs. This is where the psychic change has its journey. Meeting together, holding each other's hands. Singing together, picking together, praying together, chastising each other, loving each other, hating each other. Real world 101, isn't it? But with a set of tools to deal with that. Third part of the spiritual solution for me is the big book. Big book is broken down into trust God, clean house, and help others. I'm a big book thumper, because that's where our entire principles of AA is housed, are housed. There are other literature, the 12 and 12, and multiple other places to go find spiritual concepts. But this book was written for me. This book was written for drunks. Bill Wilson called it the common property of all mankind. Not one original thought in there, except the number one thing is, it starts off, no other spiritual program starts off by saying, I'm powerless over alcohol. It's the only one. Written for me. Written for me. I've heard people say, we've got this post-acute recovery syndrome, this wet brain syndrome. Wait for a year before you do your first fourth step because your brain won't be able to do it. That's baloney. And one of the jobs that I have where we treat 200, we have 200 men in a homeless shelter. We have 100 of them in a big book. Literally, they come into a non-medical detox, 45-bed non-medical detox. As soon as they finish that non-medical detox, we move them across the street. We put a big book in their hand, and we use Joe McQueenie's dynamics or recovery dynamics, and they literally are studying the big book with a workbook from the first day they cross from non-medical detox into that thing. They can't literally, some of them can't even write. I don't mean they don't know how to write. They've forgotten how to write. Some of them can't even remember if they got a social security number, but damn it, they can read that book. This is the preaching part. They can read that book. And we know they can read the book because we've got 5 years of working with this population that we were told was untreatable, and almost 300 of them are sober after 5 years, and they can read that book. And they can do what's in it. And when they come out into the local AA community in Louisville, I am just sitting there with tears. And people are coming. My wife came in the other day and she said, Burns, two of those guys were in our meeting this morning on Saturday morning, and somebody was talking, and it was beautiful, unaffected. And I said, that's fear. That's resentment. And this is the solution they're teaching me. And she said, my God, the whole room was stunned. Out of the mouths of babes came the message. You know? You want to wait a year to teach these guys how to read this book and do what's in it? I mean, I've sat there and walked down the hall the other day, and here's a black guy and a white guy sitting in this little cubicle. We have them two in a cubicle, and these are the two guys that meeting on the streets would have knifed each other, and I'm telling you they would have because they said they would. And they're sitting in this cubicle with 2 months of sobriety, and one of them is sewing a button on. The white guy is sewing a button on his shirt, and he looks over at the black guy, and he said, I've run out of thread. You got any thread? And he said, no, I'm out too, but I know where I can get you some. And he goes and gets him some thread, and I just sat down and cried. I just sat down and cried. Cried at the joy of seeing what was happening with these people loving each other, and cried at the privilege I've been given to be there and be a part of it. Because that's my privilege. I have been blessed. I've only told you about a third of my story, but I've told you the third that God wanted me to tell you. I've told you about all I want to tell you, come think of it. There's a whole bunch more I could tell you about my story. You know, I to make sure that you don't think that I'm just a cleaned up drunk that didn't do ugly things, I grew up in a home in Mayfield where there was no alcohol and drugs. No drugs. My grandfather was the town drunk. My mother was molested physically, emotionally, and sexually in that home. The interesting way of treating alcoholics in Mayfield at that time, when my grandfather would get drunk, they'd put him in jail. This was in 1935. When he'd sober up, they'd put him in a chain gang. He'd sweep the Mayfield City streets. My mother used to walk past her daddy at least once a week, sweeping the Mayfield City streets. My mother was ravaged by the disease of alcoholism, and it dominated our home. Mother never had a chance to deal with her rage or deal with her anger. You know, we make fun of the adult child movement, and it's absurd to do it. They've just given it a different name, but Big Book says we go back through our lives. Nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty, and gives us a solution to do it. The bad thing about adult children is that most people get into therapy long before they have a spiritual solution. You put a drunk in adult children therapy without a good spiritual solution, he'll get drunk over it because he doesn't know how to deal with the pain that he'll find in looking back at that. But my mother was a true adult child. If you read the family afterward, you find out if you were raised around one of us or liberal, unless you get goofy. It doesn't say goofy, it says you get neurotic. Well, my mother wasn't really neurotic. My mother was goofy. And she was one of the sweetest, most loving people I've ever known, so much full of a good heart and so ravaged by the disease of alcoholism. And there wasn't any alcohol in our home, and I didn't have any problem with alcohol or drugs. In high school or college, in medical school, my freshman year, I started taking amphetamine, supposedly to stay awake and study. And I got hooked on it immediately. 2 weeks before graduation, my senior year in 1962, I was kicked out of medical school. In an amphetamine rage, I beat up one of my medicine professors. They took me to the head department of psychiatry. Dr. Keller put me in intensive psychiatric therapy for 2 years. I didn't take any amphetamine. I didn't drink at that time. Didn't take any amphetamine. Got back in command of all my feelings. Was strung out on amphetamine within 30 minutes of the time I walked back into medical school. And just sat on the steps and cried because I didn't know why. I didn't know why. I was Mr. All-America growing up. I truly was. I mean, I was a kid you would want to have as your son, you want to have as your brother, you want to have as your husband. I mean, I remember the night before I went to college, and I knew I was a good kid. I remember laying in the bed the night before I went to college saying, "Dear God, if I ever have a son, I want him to be just like me," you know? And I was that good a kid. The fact is, be careful what you pray for, because you may get it. I got a son just like me. He's been in AA 13 years. I have a daughter. He's 29. He's been in AA 13 years. I have a daughter, 35, who's been in AA 15 years. And, you know, if you're Brady and you walk past the bar, when you turn the corner, you just go to an AA meeting because you're already a drunk. That's just the way it is. I mean, there's no way around it. And got back in medical school, and my classmates enabled me for a year. I'd get hot, and they'd take me home, and I'd back on the amphetamine. I got out of medical school in 64. In my internship and residency, I was hospitalized two times for severe amphetamine delirium. I got out of medical. I got out of my residency. I was hospitalized two more times. Between 64 and 67, I was in a mental hospital four times, strapped down, IV fluids, straitjackets, padded cells. I might stay off amphetamine 6 hours, 6 days, 6 weeks, 6 months. Always had to go back. It just owned me. And I just cried because I didn't know why. I just didn't know why. I tried to find it in church. I tried to find it in psychiatry. And they brought me tons of information, and they did a good job for me. They didn't bring for me the spiritual solution that you did. They just didn't do it. They just didn't do it, and they tried. And I still go to church. I served as a lay reader in the Episcopal Church for the first 7 years of my recovery, administered the chalice, administered the host, was a lay reader on Wednesdays and Sundays, and I love the church. I have no problem with therapy if it's not ignorant. If it's ignorant, it's destructive, and certainly in the case of alcoholics. So I'm not anti-therapy nor anti-religion. I believe in both of them devoutly where they are appropriate. Neither is our program, incidentally, if you really study it. But it didn't get me sober and didn't keep me clean. I went in the Army in 67. They gave me a key to the pharmacy. It's like putting a fox in a chicken house. I had the only key to the pharmacy for a dispensary in Fort Story, Virginia. And after about a year, the post commander came down and said, "Burns, are you taking amphetamine?" And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "If you don't quit, we'll put you in Leavenworth." So I quit. Hell, once he explained it to me, I quit, you know. But I still could quit. I still had that choice about quitting. And in 1969, I had my gallbladder out, got home from the Army, and in 1969, had a gallbladder attack. They took my gallbladder out. One of my best friends took it out. He's one of my best friends today. One of my best friends was the internist on the case. He's one of my best friends today. Two members of the Board of Leisinger came down with those two, sat beside the bed. Those two guys are dead. And we held hands and prayed. They said, "Burns, please get off the amphetamine. It's killing you. You're a good doctor and a good man. That stuff's killing you." And I quit. My last amphetamine was 1969. I didn't quit because I felt I was powerless, never even processed that thought. I quit because I was tired of the consequences. That was not going to be true of alcohol. As soon as I quit taking amphetamine, I never had a chance to see if I was powerless over it, because then I started drinking. First 4 years of my drinking, wasn't an alcoholic. I might get drunk, might stay sober. I never thought about it much one way or another. Got drunk a lot. My first wife will tell you I got drunk a lot. But I never thought about it. I didn't set out to get drunk. I didn't set out not to get drunk. It just wasn't a thought one way or another. Partied a lot. Next 3 years of my drinking was alcoholic. Every minute of every day was, when's that first drink coming? Every minute of it. I knew exactly when the first drink would come. It'd come at 4:15 every day. If you were in my examining room, my partner finished you up, because I walked out that door at 4 o'clock. And I mean, I was out that door, because my first drink was at 4:15. I walked over to the local grocery store, got me a quart of beer, put it between my legs, got my car on the road. It's 25 miles home. And I had that quart of beer in me by the time I got home. Then I sat down with Scotch whiskey, and I got into some serious drinking. The last year of my drinking, I drank addictively, and I drank a quart of whiskey a night. I told myself I wasn't an alcoholic, because I never drank in my office. Through a series of events, I sat with a shotgun in my mouth about that time, because I couldn't live with it and couldn't live without it. One of the things I'm convinced of today, that we need to know more and more how to do real good, solid 12-step work, and know exactly what to tell these people we're doing it on, because what we need to tell them is, you're going to die. That's what the book says, isn't it, Doug? You're going to die. You're going to die. Now, we go in and say, you need to deal with your feelings. Bullshit. You're going to die. You know? You're going to die. And we better be ready, because the insurance companies are sending them to us. They quit paying for the insurance. You know where they're sending them? They're sending them home. You thought I was finished talking, so did I, but I went back and did some more. But they're sending them home. And we better be ready, because they're coming. And we better be ready with the right message. This is the preaching and teaching part again. We better be ready, because they're coming. But I'm preaching and teaching to the choir, because y'all know what you want to do. You want to have that hand and hold it out. And they're coming home. and to be able to tell them the right message. As a doctor, all I could do when they came in, when alcoholics came in my office, was write them a prescription. And you know what that prescription, after I made sure they didn't need to be detoxed, you know what that prescription was? It had the name of an alcoholic who lived in their community. It had his address and his telephone number. And I handed them that prescription. I said, make this telephone call, because they'll give you a solution. He said, you're a doctor. And I said, I don't have one for you. Is that unique to me? No, it's right out of the book, isn't it? We don't have the solution. I don't. We do. The rest of it goes on through some incredible years of recovery. 5 years is a tough year. That's where I came to know God loves me just as I am. 10 years was when I came to know that I can't manage it, that I had to have a total 12-step program. And since that time, it's been learning to love for fun and for free like God loves me. And that's a capsule of an incredible story that's sometime, another chapter maybe, when we meet again, wherever that may be. I'm going to close with three stories. First has to do with my daughter. I'm going to talk about the things that can happen in AA. This may not happen in your life, but if you stick around in AA and you've got my problem, a miracle will happen. It may not be this miracle this way, but it's what happened in my life. My daughter, about 21 years ago, sat straddle of my chest. I was drunk and passed out. She was strung out on amphetamine, Darvon, Valium, and alcohol, and she was trying to kill me. An automatic shotgun, and all the reason she didn't kill me is because she couldn't figure out how to load it. Since that time, my daughter came in the program. When she got married, she asked me to give her away. She got a divorce, came and talked to me at great length about that, and this was a daughter who tried to kill me, and we sat and talked with the 12-step solution and as father and daughter. She got married again recently, and she asked me to give her away again. And she'd worked through that relationship with a great deal of recovery and spirituality. My son lived with Casey and me from age 11 to 14, started drinking. I didn't know it then, moved back in with his mother. His alcoholism flourished between 14 and 16 years of age. He stole all of her silverware. They both told me I can tell this story. Stole all of my wife's silverware one piece at a time. She didn't pay attention. Stole her jewelry one piece at a time. She didn't notice it. I can't believe that. She didn't pay attention. But he stole her car, and she noticed that. That's when she noticed that. And he went to jail, and she left him in jail, and he came out, and she kicked him out, and he came and asked Casey if he could live with us. And we spent a year being spiritually ready to give this answer, because I knew what I had to do. See, alcohol was killing my boy. He came and said, Daddy, can I come live with you? And I said, Burns, if you get help for your alcoholism, you can. He said, I'm not an alcoholic. I said, if you want to live with us, that's my call. If you want to live on the streets, that's yours. He said, screw you, I'll live on the streets. He lived on the streets for about 4 months. I knew where that boy was every night. If anything had happened, I knew God would lead me with my sponsors, helping with my support system, because I stayed just that tight with those guys, just like that. Every night I knew where that boy was. He didn't know I knew, but I knew. And I would have done what God and they told me to do. And I'm sure if he'd gotten in real big trouble, I would have been there. But after 4 months, he came and said, Daddy, get me help. He went off to an alcoholism treatment center and came back, got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and has been here for 13 years, gone through a lot of stuff like all of us do, hadn't found it necessary to take a drink. And I got to tell you, both those kids, and they're not kids anymore, but they'll always be kids to me. Both those kids say today that the number one thing that enabled them to get to this program was watching their daddy. My son said when he used to watch me come in when I was drinking and living at home, I'd walk in and I did something my values never allowed me to do. I might slap their mother. And that was one of the hardest things I ever had to do, not to make the amends, but to let God take away that shame and guilt from me, because I wasn't raised to hit women, and I didn't beat her, but that was the way I used to rationalize that I didn't have to go back and clean it up, because I might slap her with an open hand. I'd say, it wasn't that often, it wasn't that hard, but I got to tell you, it ate my guts out, and sure, I had to go back and do it. And when I got, and she kicked me out, and I'd call the kids and say, I'd come pick them up, and I was still drinking, and Vern said, Daddy, you just wouldn't show up. And you got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard you come home and tell Mama you were sorry, pay her money that you owed her, and then when you call us, you'd always show up. He said, when I was out there on those streets, I knew I wanted to grow up to be just like my daddy. Last story is my daddy. My mother died in 1978 of breast cancer. I had 8 months of sobriety, and every week my wife and I would drive down to see my mother before she died, and it was a wonderful period of time. I've loved my mother so much. I think about her every day, thought about her on the plane day. I think things like, Mama would love to come up here and see this country. It's a beautiful country. God, she'd love to see it. Or I'll sit out on the porch and think, Mama would love to come up and visit Casey and me in this home. Think of Mama a lot, because she's a neat lady. And she died with a lot of dignity. And I made my amends, and Mama has hugged me, and she said, I always knew what you were, Burns Max, and I never quit loving you. I'm just sorry that you got the genes of your grandfather and me. You know? When Mama died, Mama had created a monster in Daddy. She had done, and I want you women to hear this, but my daddy could build a business and knew how to do all sorts of things, only he didn't know how to wash his underwear and cook meals. And when Mama died, Dad didn't know what to do. So fortunately, God sent him another woman that was one of his mother's best friends, that was a widow, and they got married. I used to go down and try to make my amends to my daddy, and my daddy was one of these people who would never say much, never say I love you, and was just always there. Always there, one of the strongest people I've ever known. And I wanted desperately, every male I've ever worked with wants this, I wanted desperately for my daddy to say it's okay, or some significant male. There'll be a day when it isn't necessary, but it always feels good. It always feels good. And I try to make my amends, and Dad said, Burns Mac, I don't want to talk about it. So I'd go back home and I'd cry. My sponsor would say, don't try to shove it down your daddy's throat. You can't just get your freedom by hurting somebody else. And I'd say, okay. Okay, I understand. I understand. Daddy married Peggy, and then Daddy began to lose his mind. Wasn't Alzheimer's. It looks and acts like Alzheimer's, but it's what we call senile dementia. It's hardening the arteries of his brain. Daddy began to lose his mind. First he forgot who I was, and my brother, and then he forgot the mother was ever alive, and Peggy and I had to put him in a nursing home. I used to drive down about every weekend to see my daddy in a nursing home. It was a 250-mile drive, and I'd drive down there all the way. And by this is about 5 years ago, and I'd drive down. I've been sober about 14 years, and I'd drive down, and I'd say, God, take away my pain. Please take away my pain. God, take away my pain. And I'd park that car, and I'd walk in, and it'd never work. I'd get back in that car and drive all the way back crying, just gutted, because Daddy would just sit there with a blank look on his face. One Sunday I drove down and I parked that car and I got out and I went into this nursing home. He was sitting in a wheelchair. I didn't call him Daddy. That confused him. He was too weak to walk. I said, Hal, can I help you? And he looked up at me and said, yeah, Buster. That was my uncle. My Uncle Buster, his brother. He said, yeah, Buster, would you shave me? I said, sure. So I shaved my daddy. I looked at him. I said, would you like to go out and have some lunch? He said, believe I would, Buster. And I rolled him out there and I fed him. He's too weak to feed himself. About that time, Peggy came in, and she sat in the chair opposite me, and Peggy and I got to talking. Daddy's sitting in his wheelchair watching Peggy and me talk. Mother and I used to... Daddy's sitting in his wheelchair watching Peggy and me talk. Mother and I used to do this for hours. We loved to talk, and Daddy used to love to watch us talk. He was intrigued by Mother and me talking. I looked around, and I said, Hal, would you like to go out on the porch? He said, I believe I would. I rolled him out on the porch. Peggy and I sat down and got to talking again, just talking and talking. He raised up in that wheelchair. He looked me right in the face and he said, son, today you're just like the little boy your mother and I raised. I love you very much. Thank you for coming to see me. 10 seconds later, he didn't know who I was. He never knew who I was again. The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is not that my daddy recognized me, is it? The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is that this self-centered alcoholic said, let me be for my daddy what you want me to be. It's not a change in what I saw. It's a change in how I saw it. Thank you for the privilege of being with you. May God walk with you in your conscious awareness, as I know He walks in all of us. For those of you that I have seen again, it's good to see you. For those of you I've met for the first time, it's good to meet you. For those of you I have not met, we will meet as we trudge this road of happy destiny. May we do it at God's speed. It just works better. You're delightful. I love you.